Good evening. I'm Greg Donovan, Director of Creative Writing at VCU. Thank you all for coming tonight. The extreme weather gods that now seem to rule our planet have decided that there should be an enormous and historic snowstorm that will bury a good part of the northeastern U.S. tonight and tomorrow. And that storm, which the Weather Channel has now named Nemo, forced Ann Hood to cancel her travel plans of coming here. So instead, this evening is now going to be dedicated entirely to our celebration of the recent publications of two writers who live in our midst, Catherine MacDonald and Clint McCown has graciously agreed to read from his newly published novel. And so I will now introduce David Wojahn, who will introduce our first reader.
Oh, thank you, Greg. And I am not Ann Hood. But it is a special pleasure to introduce you tonight to Catherine MacDonald. As many of you know, Catherine is one of our own, an alumni of the MFA program, and for several years subsequently, she worked here as a member of the faculty of University College. I had the great honor of teaching her in several classes and serving as one of her thesis advisors. And those of you in this room who have worked with Catherine as one of her students or as one of her fellow graduate students know that she is an individual who takes the study and teaching of writing with a special seriousness and dedication. She does this because she is a writer herself of immense depth and talent. And I think the best way I could do justice to Catherine's work is to ask you to indulge me in a little fantasy. I want to pretend for a moment that I've never heard of Catherine MacDonald, that I have no idea she is one of our most distinguished VCU creative writing alumni, and that I happen to be browsing the shelves of a really good bookstore, one so good that it has a poetry section. Now, this activity would obviously make me something of a weirdo, because who browses a bookstore's poetry section for pleasure? So yes, I'm a weirdo, but I'm also a weirdo who is very hard to please. I love looking for books by new poets, but I'm a very picky customer. 3/4 of the first or second books of poetry I see on a bookstore shelf look to me like the same old writers who are talented but derivative, talented but slick and vapid. But all of a sudden, I come upon a book entitled Rousing the Machinery. I pick it up because its title intrigues me, and I see that the book has won one of the most significant poetry book awards, the Miller Williams Prize. So far, so good. And I see that on the back of it has a book jacket endorsement by Pulitzer Prize winner Claudia Emerson that allows that these poems are remarkable, full of wise surprise and beautifully made. And I read the words of another esteemed poet, Betty Adcock, who calls the collection a startling and stunning book. I see, too, that individual poems in the collection have appeared in really good journals, and as I sit in the bookstore, I start reading the poems, and after one or two of them, I am hooked. I am entranced. I might even go as far as to say, I am awed. These are not the poems of a tyro, but of a grown woman, mature and confident in her vision and in her voice. They're full of linguistic precision as well as linguistic surprise, and always, always the stakes set forth in the poems are exceedingly high. They deal with emotive basics, childhood, family, and the intricacies of memory as they converge with the intricacies and mysteries of motherhood. But they also follow the example of some of my favorite poets, most notably George Opin and Robert Lowell, for they insist that personal history and public history are in the end one and the same. These poems take place in the middle of life's journey, but they are never lost in Dante's dark wood. The poems are sure of themselves, so sure of themselves that they are willing to embrace tragedy as well as delight. that they are willing to be both admirably grounded and blissfully unmoored. As I stand in my imaginary bookstore, paging Rousing the Machinery, I know I'm going to buy this book and also the two other copies that sit beside it on the shelf. For this writer is such a discovery, I need to share my good fortune with others. Catherine MacDonald is the author of Rousing the Machinery and a chapbook entitled How to Leave Home. Her poems have appeared in dozens of the finest literary journals. She's been a fellow of the Sewanee Writers Conference and the Virginia Center for Creative Arts, and it is a singular privilege to introduce her to you tonight. Catherine MacDonald.
And it is a singular privilege to be introduced by David Wojahn, who, you know, my admiration for you truly has no bounds. I know sometimes readings of poetry or fiction can feel like a mutual admiration club or a circle jerk or whatever. However, I thank you, David. When I began my MFA degree here at VCU, to have stood at the podium to be introduced by my mentor, David, is something that I would never have even confided that I was thinking about, right? It was just the hubris. I don't have it. But thank you. It's lovely to be here. It's incredibly wonderful to read with Clint McCown, who served as a reader as well on my thesis and gave me invaluable advice and feedback on it. So many people who I love are here from VCU's community, so thank you, and friends as well. So it's wonderful to be here. It's like the first day of class. I have sweaty palms. I'm a sweaty palmed person, but I'll just go ahead and jump into the book. So thank you. First poem in the book is titled Grace. In this raw corner of a no-rank town, rusting swing sets wobble under the weight of fierce children as thunderstorm torrents ride pin-straight alleys down the backsides of backyards. When they think no one is looking, my brothers pee on the alley storm grates. This is my footpath to Grace, seventh house on the left. An air conditioner, the only one for blocks, sweats and sighs in her jammed open front window as August simmers. Grace is abandoned. A monkey balances on her bare right shoulder, simpers and shrieks, grips her dull blonde hair with an infant's avid hands. It's a gift from her ex, an airman late of Saigon. Outside her door, frothy mimosas waft scent over the dying lawn as she ties one on. Don't bother with her, my mother scolds. She's a drunk. But I knock anyway, every day. Drawn by the monkey's cry and the air conditioner's cold invitation, I face Grace on her front stoop. As roaring jets rope the morning sky, Grace raises her glass and invites me inside. You know, I'm old, as you can tell, middle-aged. So this is, however, it is a first collection, a full collection of poems. So the arc of the book, kind of like many books of poetry, a first book of poetry, it kind of follows the arc of my life. So I'll read a couple of poems from each section, and it'll kind of move you through my childhood into my middle age and maybe a little bit past there as well. So that's the first poem in the book. Also from the first section of the book, Indian style in front of the tube. On Wednesday nights, we sit for the rifleman, then for Fred and Ethel, Lucy and Ricky, for little Ricky too, like our own little Ricky, youngest of five, redolent of baby shampoo, plump in my lap, hot from his bath. It's still years before his prison term, cable, the internet, and his own silent son, but it's swimming towards us. We'll crest one wave, then another. But tonight it's television. Of course, we think our mother is just like Lucy, only not funny, and our father just like Ricky, only not Cuban, and he can't play a note. Lucy's feisty, always in a scrape with him, the hot-tempered blade, bongo battering hunk. Can you imagine him in Havana, the music thick in his head, that pout, his wavy black hair, or swimming the Florida Straits, conga strapped to his back? This is the life, bowl of pistachios, peanuts, and popcorn as we watch Ricardo rise from the waves, storm Manhattan, and light the ladies' cigarettes at the Club Babaloo. But poor Lucy's got some splaining to do as she carves charred chicken and dresses down the kids. You know, it's all part of a long letting go, a rerun in pings and flutters in the crankcase of the brain, you monkey you. As I moved through the collection today and I was trying to select poems to read, I found that I was really drawn to the poems of childhood. And as David mentioned, I'm very interested in the life of children and mothers. I'm the mother of two sons, and so the lives of young boys in particular just really fascinates me. So you may find that that's a theme that'll kind of recur regarding the poems that I've selected to read tonight. The next poem is entitled Blue Strobe, it's also a poem about growing up, set in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it's the only time I was ever almost arrested. So, all right. So it's remarkable, and I have documented it thoroughly and accurately and completely truthfully in this poem. So let's see, Blue Strobe. I was almost arrested once, an open bottle of St. Pauli Girl cooling my palm in a Charlottesville alley. The cop, he yelled, mostly at the man I was with. Sometimes it's good to be a girl when boys hide out, assemble forts. It's not all innocent fun, I know, but it is fun slipping stoned down a steep drive, past the loading dock, in through a door too warped to close. The old hospital is half demolished, and they've broken in here before, drawn to its echoes and stuccoed ruin. You couldn't break it any more than it's already broken. In the chapel, on the fifth floor, they've fashioned a space. This is where they're caught, spattering walls and pews with gold spray paint, left over from last year's Spanish project, a cardboard model of the Alcazar of Segovia, the carpet littered with raisinettes, as if life were a movie matinee. As if life were an excursion to the library, these are the books they brought there. The Rum Diaries, Rumi, Chomsky, Starfighter, Calvin and Hobbes. Just what is it boys need? I know it's not in their book bags or in the deep pockets of their cargo pants. This life has a soundtrack. It loops through wire and plastic buds rooted in the ear. Belle and Sebastian, the Zombies, Johnny Cash, all singing about the demise of childhood, while a signal from a joystick ragdolls virtual victims in a simulated Ardennes forest, circa 1944, or Vice City's ferocious streets, circa 1983, or an animated Neverwinter, circa forever and ever. So oaks wilt and wounded elms doff their crowns, which don't sit lightly on the spindly necks of winter wrecks, no leaves yet. These shut-fast houses beneath bent trees, that's what I asked for, square above a racing river, the velocity of its current calculated remotely by strobe and transmitted via satellite to engineers who wait restlessly to wring meaning from raw data. Six boys, hands flat on the hood of an unmarked police car, circa 2008. Its blue strobe is the river's pulse at its sharpest bend, wildest branch, and highest bluff. So I think I'll continue along in the theme of crime and criminals. This is a poem called Notes on Prison, and poems tend to be fairly autobiographical, and I did have a brother who was briefly imprisoned here in Virginia, and this poem, you know, kind of imaginatively takes the experience of, you know, I don't know what his experience was, obviously, but of our family as we dealt with and encountered this part of his life. I come from a really large family. I was just describing to somebody that we're real peasants, blue collar, we work hard, and sometimes we go to jail. So, but then we get out and we make it good. So, notes on prison. We love our brother, so we visit him in prison, where he, possession with intent, and Carlos, manslaughter, are buddies, cellmates. They live together, share shampoo, and the sci-fi novels our sister brings. Carlos is a man with a business plan, an artist from Jalisco. He shows us his sketchbooks, the Basilica of the Virgin of Zapopan, patroness of epidemics and thunderstorms. His sister strumming the fihuela, a man's open palm. But here, it's reverse paintings on glass for sale or barter. Maybe Disney for baby, or one of the Bible's bad boys for mama, or your sweetheart's face copied from a wrinkled photo. No photo? No problem. Just her name then, leaking sapphire tears over a bulging heart, your name in hard black letters in the middle. So Sundays we bear tubs of fried chicken and bags of donuts to Deerfield Prison for Men. We get to know the guards. Pines rise above the stucco and tin, the din of women wrapped around thin boys or thick-set men who must say it now, say it fast, say it loud. The lawyer called, or didn't. No, your father, he won't come here. and I can't forgive or forget or forego any of it. Of course, this was years ago. We took a few pictures. We took our children to see their uncle, who didn't say much, just carried leftovers back to his cell for Carlos, whose faraway family thought he was dead. All right, so the next one I'm going to read is a poem. It's kind of an older poem, and for a while there, like many people, I tried to read a little Marx. I think I was feeling oppressed in my work situation. I'm a mother, and I've cleaned my house repeatedly over the years. And so this poem is called Estranged Labor, and it kind of moves into, I think, maybe the second part of the book, which deals with getting older and having stuff that you have to take care of. So, Estranged Labor. This is the work of the house. You are in charge of the grass. I am in charge of the plates. You stalk live game. Every pursuit, a compromise. The pale interior absolving the elements outside. You fight the numberless leaves. I slaughter the hens and keep their pimpled flesh from the hound. This is the work of the house. You salt the slug. I wrestle the twisted limb from the blazing tree. Consider the sweep of carpet moss, the lure of a wireworm snaking the drain. Tail curled above muscled hawk, the gaze hound wakes from uneasy sleep, her eyes on the spilled drawer, the door ajar. The next poem I'm going to read is called House Hunters, and it begins, I'm kind of an epigraph addict, like a lot of people, I think, who write anything. You're reading all of the time and probably collecting information from the many places that you go as a reader, right? And many times they find your way into the poem or a short story, or maybe they are the trigger for the piece that you're gonna write. And this is a quote that I read many years ago while looking at a biography of Louisa May Alcott, of course, who's right, the author of, among other things, Little Women. In the biography, the relationship she had with her father is described, Bronson Alcott, a very difficult and intense man, an educator himself. And anyway, she accompanied him to the funeral of Longfellow, the poet Longfellow. And while she was there, she overheard a remark from Ralph Waldo Emerson that is reported in the biography that I just found very moving. The poem is called House Hunters. It deals with the end of my own mother's life, and the epigraph comes from that biography. House Hunters. Where are we? Whose house is this? And who is the sleeper? Emerson at Longfellow's funeral. Just before she drifts off, oxygen, cannula, delivering its sibilant flow, my mother observes that tonight's young couple on our favorite show hasn't the right energy for the hunt. She's a whiner, he's a lunk. It will elude them, she says, the sexy master suite, granite kitchen facing a fenced backyard, perfect for two enviable dogs, stand-ins for children still to come. Will it be the ranch or the cape, close in or far out? Round each cul-de-sac, they'll wonder, can you see yourself here, rooted in place like a nerve or a nail? Lately, my mother rarely leaves the house, so we spent the day on family photos, Easter and Christmas, baskets and bows, year after year, her children in rows, crowding the stoop or circling the pine, elbow to elbow in a lengthening line. There are a few of her, too, sweeping a room or at the stove, one baby or another astride her hip, always a cigarette burning between her lips. At house number 3, I wake her. It's time to choose. She slips her glasses down her nose. Even a fool can see how this will go. So I'm talking about House Hunters, the legendary program on HTV, right? We're out there, right, with those eager young couples making their first big purchase. I think I'll read one more poem from the book, and then I'll read a couple of new poems before I finish. I think I'll read the title poem called Rousing the Machinery. This poem begins with an epigraph from William Blake, and the genesis of the poem comes from me, you know, learning about William Blake's poetry, learning about his life, and thinking about zoos and circuses. You know, William Blake wrote the poem that many of us had to memorize a long time ago, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright. So you ask yourself, did this young man who came from the working classes of London a long time ago, did he ever see a tiger, or is this the work totally of his imagination? So it begins with an epigraph from Blake and kind of moves through experiences I have in classrooms in North Carolina. Rousing the machinery. The tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. William Blake, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. It's in two sections. One, observe the perpetual boy as one with a pop-eyed crowd. He's come to see the king's menagerie, camel, bear, leopard, lion, tiger, stripe over stripe, swinging its heavy head with each sullen step. He notes the fixed pit of its pupil, the eyes bulge and slow blink. Who will extol this captive pacing the round tower room? Who will grind its bones for luck, pluck stiff whiskers for a paintbrush, rend fat for an aphrodisiac? Who will inhale scent of musk, tang of urine soaked in stone, sing marvelous its assets? A boy. Two. This morning in Raleigh's exurban flank, I watched the bad boys of Selma Alternative High School craft paper wasps. They loft them across the bedlam of the classroom to where the tiger, perfect bound, sleeps in my hands. With a stroke, a stroke, a stroke, the machinery is roused, and in the corner of the classroom, above our heads, gangly wasps disgorge wood to make paper. Watch. The miracle occurs in a vessel, an enclosure, in a lidded pot on a hot stove, in a woman's body where a child grows, or in the insect jaw, ganglia and lobe. All right, and I'll close with a couple of poems that are newer poems. I'm working on a second manuscript, which is tentatively entitled The Unkept House, which describes the state of my life most of the time. So, right, you go to what you know for the material you need. The poem is also about, a couple of years ago, there was an exhibit that moved around the world that basically was this extraordinary piece of textiles that was made from the silk of the, the Madagascan female golden orb spider. It was a pretty extraordinary thing. So somewhere in the world, a textile artist and an entrepreneur had milked 1 million of these female spiders to draw the silk from them. And there are devices that will allow you to extract both poison or silk from spiders. You can watch YouTube videos of this if you're so inclined. Scientists do it, entrepreneurs do it, and I never knew about it, that one could do to make this material. So this is a poem that kind of its genesis maybe is in that. It's a short poem. It's called The Unkept House. In the unkept house, sleepers sigh, and the spider spins. In the unkept house, the sleep of the child is the keeper's sleep, the sigh of the child, her sigh. In the unkept house, silk crosshairs the scope and trellises the eaves. In the unkept house, the child's breath clots the keeper's breath. We pack the wounds with silk. In the unkept house, dragline and filament unfurl as the keeper milks the spider for her silk. In the unkept house, we are thralls to the thread and the spool. So that's one of those like domestic unhappiness poems, I guess. So this next poem is called The Suburban Weed Society. And again, its genesis comes from, when I lived in Raleigh, North Carolina, a place which I love very much, great city to live in. It's a much more high functioning place in terms of its corporate life than Richmond is. But I read about this thing called the Southern Weed Society, and it's a group of soil scientists and basically scientists who study weeds and basically try to figure out how to totally eradicate them from the face of the earth. And at one point after a hurricane, I was in the same position where our yard, Raleigh, all of the trees had fallen and weeds had taken over in the sunshine. So this poem is called The Suburban Weed Society, which I had joined. Suburban Weed Society. Where curly dock and dandelion bluster in sun, Elizabeth and I dig in. FEMA has come and gone. Hurricane Fran, having dropped 12 heavy pines, dubbing my yard future weed exposition. Men have hauled logs, chainsawed and tacky with resin to the cul-de-sac curb. The camellias are crushed, the patio cracked, and the ground now says yes, yes to buckhorn and wild sorrel, fringe trees and hop clove. In just 1 month, my sister plans to be married here, so Elizabeth arrives, with gloves, shovels, axe, surveys the ground. Start here, she says. All the Queen Anne's laced must go. My last season in this house, this city, I am learning how the years blow past, how despite its gear and grin, the past smashes its blow against the present. My ever anxious son, Elizabeth's daughter, wheelchair bound, who waits to be lifted again and again into the Dodge Caravan, in this yard, stripped to its bones, knuckling under. And the very last poem that I'll read is called Symmetry and Arrangement. It's a very fresh poem. It's just a week or two old, so it's a baby poem. And, you know, as I said, I'm getting older. And as you get older, maybe it's even happening to you now if you're young, your body is kind of like an enigma machine, and you're constantly trying to decrypt the messages that it's sending you. Right? So that's just part of getting older. So I think this poem's pretty straightforward. Symmetry and Arrangement. Through her surgical loop, ground glass, lit, polished, and coated to reduce the reflection and refraction of light on my belly, the dermatologist coolly eyes the oval borders of paired moles flanking my navel. Nevus, nevi, rough partners risen to the surface of my skin, sentinels of the scar of that first rift from which we slip or lift into the very air our mothers breathe. Of me and my dark partners, the doctor says, oh, the sweet girl, how she strives, even here, for symmetry. Thank you all. Thank you for coming.
This afternoon I had the pleasure of, and the pain of, having to write a little essay called On the Difficulty of Having to Write an Introduction for Clint McCown. The primary difficulty with introducing Clint McCown is trying to figure out what to leave out. First of all, most people around these parts probably know that he is a dedicated and very effective teacher, held in high esteem by his students and his colleagues here at VCU. But then, should I go way back and tell you that he was born in Fayetteville, Tennessee, and then grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, during the racial conflicts of the early 1960s? Do I mention that his father worked in the Secret Service, and that helped him land the job of mowing the grass for President Dwight Eisenhower when Clint was a teenager? Do I include that after graduating from Wake Forest, he studied acting at the Circle in the Square in New York City, and subsequently toured with the National Shakespeare Company? Should I mention that before turning to fine arts writing, Clint worked as a broadcast journalist in Montgomery, Alabama, earning an Associated Press Award for documentary excellence for his investigations of organized crime and corruption in Alabama politics? Do I leave out the fact that he has worked as a screenwriter for Warner Brothers and as a creative consultant for HBO Television, or that three of his plays have been produced? Certainly, I might mention that he was the founding editor and publisher of the Beloit Fiction Journal for 20 years, and that he has edited 27 collections of fiction, and that his own work has appeared in more than 50 national journals. But should I mention his cross-country trip on a motorcycle? Even if I stick only to the seemingly most relevant facts, I would have to tell you that he is a true multi-genre writer, and that he's the author not only of four volumes of poetry, most recently Dead Languages from Anhinga Press, but also that he has published four novels, including The Member Guest, War Memorials, and The Weatherman, as well as his most recent publication, Haints, issued this past October from New Rivers Press, and from which I hope he'll read tonight. But then I probably would have to start enumerating all the honors and awards that his writing has earned, including his being the only two-time winner of the American Fiction Prize, his winning the Society of Midland Authors Award, the S. Mariela Gabriel Prize, and a Barnes & Noble Discover Great Writers designation, as well as a National Endowment for the Arts grant, and more. And soon, there wouldn't be any time left for his reading. So I better not do any of that. And instead, I think I'll just thank him for agreeing to read for us tonight, and then I'll say, here's Clint McCown, and I'll sit down.
I apologize for not being Ann Hood. I have taught with Ann, and I have given readings with Ann. I've never had to replace Ann, and that is by far the most difficult of the three. I had planned on spending my evening milking silk from Madagascan orb spiders, but that hasn't worked out. Catherine, thank you for that lovely reading. I have long loved your work. I do have to say it unnerves me to hear someone so much younger than I am talk about the problems of aging. Where does that leave me? What I'm going to read here is the prologue from this new novel, Haints, because prologues basically don't require any explanation. I will tell you, just since so many of you are writing students, that this prologue was actually the last part of the book that I wrote. It's set in a small southern town, and this prologue takes place on February 29th, 1952. Signalman Third Class Ronald Dawson, Ronnie Boy to his dead shipmates, made his way up the aisle of the bus and eased himself into the torn seat behind the driver. "I need to get off here," he said. The driver looked at him in the rearview mirror. Ronald knew the man was sizing him up. Passengers weren't supposed to get off between towns. But maybe the uniform would make a difference. That's all the driver was likely to see. "You got any baggage to pull out?" Ronald thought about the question. Everything he owned lay stuffed inside the canvas seaman's bag in the compartment underneath the bus. "No, sir," he said. "Nothing." The driver let out a small snort, as if he just lost an argument, and steered the bus onto the shoulder. "I got a kid brother in Korea," he said, as he pulled the lever that folded the door aside. A brother in Korea. That was appropriate. Rules were being broken. Exceptions were being made. His dead shipmates were clearing a path for him now. "Better get where you're going," the driver said as Ronald stepped out into the dazzling sunlight. Ronald squinted back at the driver, who was now just a shadow perched behind the wheel. "They're calling for thunderstorms." Ronald didn't care about thunderstorms, but he scanned the sky anyway to be polite. Sure enough, a steep bank of clouds was already rolling up from the northwest end of the county. "Thanks," he said. The driver closed the door, and Ronald watched as the bus pulled back onto the crumbling blacktop and disappeared around a bend. An eddy of dust swirled across his shoes, softening their gleam. He was alone again, more or less. He took a slow breath. The approaching clouds were dark and greenish, almost like the sea. "Don't watch the sky, Ronnie boy," said his dead shipmates. "That's not your job." They were right, as always. The hike to his grandfather's old cabin was a difficult one, not only for the steepness of the terrain, but for the unfamiliarity, which he hadn't expected. The deer trails he'd followed as a boy had all melted back into the landscape. Maybe the herds had thinned out over the years, or just shifted away, moving to more remote ground now that every crossroad in the county had sprouted a noisy filling station or a neon-framed steakhouse. In any case, the old paths were gone. Or maybe he was wrong about that. Maybe the deer were still there, threading their same old route up the mountain, and he was the one who had changed, the one who could no longer find his way among the sharp outcroppings of rock and fallen trees and the brown tangle of last year's vines. He'd grown used to the sea, with its overwhelming sky and its own faint and temporary trails, so broad and flat, sometimes dissolving right before his eyes. He never worried about finding his way over the water. The ship took care of that.
giving everyone on board a common direction. But here on land, each step was once again his own, a terrible uncertainty. And for long stretches of the climb, he suspected he was lost. But the voices kept pushing him forward, driving him up the rugged slope through wave after wave of budding undergrowth. When at last he broke through to the crest of the ridge, he was exhausted. But that was all right. He had little left to do. The cabin was gone now, save for the blackened stone pilings of the foundation and a few charred boards jutting like bones from the pit. Lightning, he imagined, or maybe vandals. Years ago, from the look of it, most of the ash had washed away. "I know," Ronald said before his dead shipmates could chide him. "It's none of my concern." He had no claim on this land. The TVA had seized the property before he left for the Navy. The law of eminent domain, they'd called it. And they'd paid only enough for him to bury his grandfather, whose heart had burst over the loss. But that's what governments did, after all. Sacrifice the few for the sake of the many. The country needed hydroelectric power. Dams were being built all along the Tennessee River and its tributaries, and soon the entire valley of his childhood would be flooded. The old roads and country stores and even the forests themselves would all be underwater. He took it as one more sign. Water would follow him wherever he tried to go, even into the past. There was no point trying to escape it. He walked to the overhang and stared across the valley as the rolling gray-green sky lowered itself over the opposite ridge. The storm would be on him in a few minutes. At his feet, he could make out the last traces of the danger line, that thick yellow stripe his grandfather had painted across the rock shelf so many years ago. Ronald had been forbidden to cross that line. Beyond the smooth ledge tilted downward, and a clumsy step could send a boy sliding off into space, into a 100-foot drop to the rocky creek bed below. But he'd never been good at following orders, even then. And though his grandfather never knew it, Ronald had crossed that painted line the day he turned 13. Not boldly, because in truth, he'd always had a crippling fear of heights. But he'd crossed it nevertheless, creeping down the incline on his hands and knees, daring himself forward, inching toward that terrifying edge until at last, shaking and prickling with sweat, he could look straight down the cliff and imagine what might be. Because frightened as he was, he still wanted to know what it would be like to cross that next line, that final line, the one that could not be uncrossed. Dizziness had swamped him then, and he almost took the plunge. Of course, he'd recovered himself, and shaken by whatever devil had tempted him to crowd the edge, to push that point of no return, he'd scrambled back to safety across his grandfather's yellow line. He never crossed it again. Until now. "You're not a sailor anymore," his dead shipmates reminded him. The sneer in their voices was unbearable. He sighed and took off his shoes. The toes were scuffed from the climb, which disturbed him. He liked having a good shine on his shoes. The old man had always admired whatever was well pressed and polished. Too bad he never got to see Ronald in uniform. He spat on the shoes and buffed them with the end of his neckerchief until the gleam was again so deep and clear He could see himself in the glossy blackness, the long pale face, white buzz-cut hair. His features were distorted, but that was just as well. Ronald hadn't been able to look himself in the face for more than a year now. 1 year and 27 days, to be exact. 1 year and 27 days since his mind had wandered while he was standing watch, since he had failed to sound the alarm. Not that it was all that easy to spot mines bobbing in dark water, but he'd been trained. He knew what to look for. People had counted on him to keep them safe. And he had wanted to, of course he'd wanted to, but he'd never been much good at holding his focus. The waters were calm and the horizon was clear, and somewhere in the long stretch of the evening, his mind had just drifted away. He found himself daydreaming about what he might do after the war, about maybe finding a girl and a piece of land someplace. Not in the Tennessee mountains, but near the shore, where he could always look out at the ocean, which had become the place he loved most. Maybe he could set himself up with some kind of excursion boat in Florida and take tourists on fishing trips or sightseeing tours. He could arrange a business loan to get started. He'd be a war veteran, after all, a man to be respected, the kind of man bankers would always be willing to bank on. The first he knew of the mine was when it exploded against the hull. And that was that. 8 men dead, 6 wounded. The USS Partridge taking on water, then listing lazily to the starboard side, then sinking to the bottom of Wonsan Harbor. Strange that all he lost was his cap. Well, that and everything else. He tucked his socks inside his shoes and set them gently on the yellow line. His neckerchief and bell bottoms flapped in the rising wind. He took off the rest of his clothes, folding the uniform as neatly as he could. Not crisp enough to pass inspection, but respectful at least. He placed the clothes beside his shoes, but the wind was wilder now, and before he'd even straightened up, his uniform tumbled away up the incline, the white suit billowing and flopping along the stony ground like some drunken ghost. No matter. The Navy was just one more ruined cabin to him now, one more abandoned piece of ground. He'd stood on the dry deck of the rescue ship watching the fresh crew search for bodies they would never find. His commanding officer, Lieutenant Clark, was among the lost. Ronald assumed that was why he was never brought up on charges. No officer to file a report. But whatever the reason, from that moment until his redeployment to the States a year later, no one ever said a word about his failure. No one suggested a court-martial. No one accused him of dereliction of duty. No one said anything to him at all. It was as if he had disappeared with his dead shipmates. Maybe that's why they talked to him now. Ronald rose to attention and walked naked out onto the weathered slab, stopping a half step from the edge. A few large drops of rain spattered across the rock face like the first few notes of a discordant song. He peered down at the familiar litter of boulders below. This time he felt no fear, not the smallest tremor, not the slightest chill. He looked out again at the doomed valley, hoping for one last happy glimpse of something he had once loved. Instead, he saw the angry hand of God whirling in a dark spiral, reaching down from the heavens, snatching up fistfuls of branches and stones and debris as it rampaged back and forth across the hollow. Ronald felt one final surge of dread. "Don't think this squares anything," said his dead shipmates. "I won't," Ronald told them. He closed his eyes and leapt. Thanks.